So, hi, my name is Ismail. My colleague is.
Hey, I'm Eugene. I work at Google. I've spent most of the past 6 years working on Beam and Dataflow and other distributed data processing stuff.
Okay, and well, I work for Talent, and I have worked mostly on this IO area, and we have worked together also in this new API, so we're going to present a little of the new ideas of IOs in Beam. So, I'll start. Okay. So first, we have this agenda. We are going to do a small introduction to Beam, really short for people who were not in the previous session, but it's just a general idea. Then we are going to discuss the idea of having IOs as a data processing task, and this is kind of a new pattern that we want to promote into Beam. And then we also are going to discuss about IO implementation patterns, which are common cases that we find when you are writing an IO connector, and how can you tackle these cases. And finally, well, we'll discuss the future work and what's going on. So first, Apache Beam is a unified programming model, which we mean with unified is that this unifies both batch and streaming. That is a concept that we want to make disappear with Apache Beam. And we use this model to execute these data processing jobs in a portable way among different runners. So the idea is that all the programs in Beam are represented with direct acyclic graph, a DAG, that brings data from a data store, let's say, like the cylinders there, and do transformations, do this graph of transformations, and produces output. We call these P transforms, and these arrows are P collections, which represent the data. And these transforms, well, map with the classical MapReduce transforms. We call this Pardue in Beam. It's like a batteries included map or flat map. We have the group by key transforms, which correspond, let's say, to group by key plus reduce. And then the main goal in Beam is that you can use these transforms to compose new transforms. So we have composite transforms via those. And it's the case, for example, of this sum transform that is a composition of both. But more interesting, the Beam model brings a new set of concepts that allows to have some kind of deterministic streaming. And to do this, every element in Beam has an event time associated with it. But in general, what we try to do is to represent when we are going to aggregate data. And to do this, we have the concept of triggers. So in the end, it's about the trade-off of calculating results in advance or waiting more time to have more precise results. So this is what the Beam model brings extra to the table. And well, this is the code for the classical word count that is the hello world of the big data world. And as you can see, we connect transformations with this word apply. And we start reading a text file from HDFS. Then we are going to code the words and with a flat map that is also a Pardue in our terminology. We then count these elements, and finally we map and put them out. It's again, it's an, you can easily imagine the progression of the graph in the left. And the idea is that you write this program. This program is represented in the Beam model, and you can, with the Beam runners, execute it in any of these destination systems. So today, you start with a program in Java or Python, and you can run it in these systems, for example, in Spark, on Apache Flink, but even also in the cloud, in Google Dataflow. So we have users who write these programs, this connection of graphs with their user-defined functions. And we have also libraries that help them to have an easier life. And in particular, we have a set of IOs libraries to connect to different data stores and databases, and also to write to those. We have the languages, the case that we mentioned, including Go. We have the general representation of the Beam model and the runners that translate this into every system. We have, for the case of this presentation, well, we focus on the I/O connectors and how we get data input in and out of the system. And we have a healthy set of connectors in Apache Beam. all maintained by the Apache community in our repositories. So we have components to integrate with messaging systems, with databases, with index-like things like Apache Solr, and even cloud-based stuff like the Google Cloud, all the databases of Google Cloud, and some of the Amazon ones. So why we talk about I/O is because I/O is an essential part of what we do. We most of the time, all these data processing frameworks discuss the model of the of programming, but few discuss how we get data in and data out. But in the end, most of the pipelines that people write, and in particular in Beam, are all about taking data in, transforming somehow this data, and putting this data out. So this is the classical ETL problem. But let's say that ETL is the ETL problem, but we don't talk about two of the letters so in general, so it's time probably to talk more about this. But problem also is that I/O is not so simple as it seems. I mean, sometimes we think, okay, I'm just going to read a file, so I just need a file name and I read it. But in reality, when you read the file, you discover that the file has a header. So now you cannot read it as you read it before. The component you had to read it needs to be modified. And this there are so many possible cases. And then, for example, there is this weird system that you receive a file with the name of the table. So now you need to, the connector you had doesn't work because it didn't expect a file with the name of the tables because that's so it's normal. And also sometimes you have dependencies, like for example, you want to write some data before you write other data. So there are all kinds of cases that are not covered by the current APIs for I/O connectors. And they are not covered because it's messy, let's say. And also I/O has another problem, is that it's unforgiving. And with this, we mean that correctness is critical. Any bug in an I/O connector implies that you lose data or that you are analyzing wrong data. And also, in these systems, well, of course, we are talking about distributed systems, so we have to have to know how to react when there are failures, so fault tolerance is important. And some of these data stores have guarantees that others don't, some support exactly once reads or writes. So all of these are details that have to be tackled. And performance-wise also, well, ideally, we should process in parallel the most things that we can. But we also have other issues that can happen in the meantime. We can have issues with throughput, or we can have issues with memory. So I/O is not an easy area. But at the same time, I/O is a chance to do things better. As it says in the slide, nobody pays that much attention to this area. In particular, nobody has wrote a paper who talks deeply about I/O, for example. And why is this? Because the requirements are too diverse, and well, people say like, well, this is probably an user problem, and definitely is. But if you don't provide good abstractions to compose I/Os, well, probably people are going to write by hand things and not doing it well. So this happens why? Because the APIs are too rigid and force people to fork them and do some things by hand. So what we want to improve on this is have better APIs to write I/Os and have a more compositional approach to do that.
All right. So Beam's answer to all of the above is to take a substantially different approach to I/O than is traditionally taken, and that is to treat I/O as just another case of data processing. Turns out if you do that, then all of those problems magically disappear, and all it takes is to stop thinking of I/O as special. Let's elaborate on that a bit. So traditionally, distributed data processing frameworks think of sources and sinks as something special that happens at the edge of the pipeline. And they have dedicated APIs for reading data and dedicated APIs for writing data, and they are completely separate from the rest of the programming model. For example, in Hadoop we have input format, in Flink, in Spark we have receivers, in Flink we have source functions and respective things for writing. And all of them accept some kind of configuration, and in your pipeline you say like read data using this input format, then goes the rest of the beautiful Spark programming model, then goes like write data to this sink. So this is unfortunately very rigid, and worse, it is not hackable. So as long as you hit something that is not anticipated by this pattern of I/O happening at the edge of the pipeline, you're screwed. And there's really nothing you can do. For example, if you have file names coming on a Kafka topic, you cannot use a connector for reading files to read files whose names come on a Kafka topic. If you have like a table per client and you have a data set containing a list of clients whose tables you want to read, you can't use a database connector to do that, because you need to specify the table name when you construct the pipeline. You can't say table name comes from the data set. There are other cases, like if you're writing data, you might want to know which records failed to write and maybe write them somewhere else. But a sync cannot return any data, so you don't know which records failed to write, and so on. So this lack of composability is quite damning for the traditional way of doing I/O. And that is why Beam is taking a different approach. Beam's approach is to treat I/O as just another data processing task, meaning it's literally expressed using exactly the same programming primitives as any other kind of data processing. It's also done basically using map and reduce. It sounds unintuitive at first, but as we shall soon see, it makes total sense. So for example, when you're reading files, you should not think of it as a source. You should think of it as a transform that takes globs and returns records in the files matching those globs. When you're reading from a database, you should think of it as a transform that takes query parameters and executes queries with these parameters and returns rows. When you're writing data to a database, it's a transform that takes rows and returns like statistics of successful imports into the database and failed rows. So depending on the particular I/O use case, the exact interface of this is of course going to be different, but the point is that you should not restrict yourself to like not having any input when reading data and not having any output when writing data. Just think of it as transforms. Once you start thinking in this way, and by the way, you don't really need Beam to think in this way. This approach makes total sense in Spark and Flink. And really, if there's one thing people take from this talk, is if you don't like Beam, if you like Spark and Flink, please go and adopt this there. Your user is probably going to thank you. So the thing is that once you start thinking of I/O in this way, you get a lot of benefits for free. You get composability, you get unlimited scalability for free. For example, when you're reading 1 million files, that's usually a big problem for distributed data processing frameworks, because they like create one shard per file, or worse, one shard per chunk of file. But once you think of the task of reading 1 million files as just a transform that processes 1 million elements, of course there's nothing difficult about processing 1 million elements. And actually adopting this approach to reading files in Beam has resolved, I think, a 3-year-old bug in Dataflow that said, do not be embarrassed about how many files we can process. So unlimited scalability comes for free, and it's pretty nice. You automatically get or are forced into unifying batch and streaming behavior. You automatically get fault tolerance that Pardoes and group by keys give you, and so on. So there are no downsides. It's all good. Another upside is that once you start thinking of I/O as composable, you start thinking of it as decomposable. So once you adopt the idea that you can build things from things, you're wondering what are the smallest building blocks from which you can build these things. So you start thinking of what are the smallest useful things you can provide instead of trying to provide one big I/O connector that does everything the user wants. Instead, you start thinking of what's the smallest things I can provide from which users can build anything they want. For example, if we think about reading text files, that's not a monolithic transform. It's a composition of two transforms, one that takes globs and expands them, possibly continuously and emitting new files matching the globs, which in itself can use a utility transform that repeatedly invokes a function and returns new results. And the second transform is a transform that takes a name of a text file and reads the text file. So these transforms are independently useful. You might use the globe expanding transform in some other cases, for example, for reading other file formats, or maybe for, I don't know, matching files to a file pattern and deleting them, or something else. Likewise, when you're reading, for example, a Kafka topic, you can also think of it as a composition of two transforms, one that lists the partitions of the topic, and here again, you can reuse the transform that returns you new results of a function to watch new partitions that appear in this topic, and the second transform that takes a topic in a partition and continuously reads records in that partition. So these are examples of composing and decomposing various I/O-related things. Here are some examples of how you can use file-related transforms as part of some other workflow. For example, if you want to import data into a database using CSV, you can reuse the existing transform for reading CSV files. So you write a transform that asks the database to dump data to CSV. Then once it completes, you ask to read all those CSV files, and then you parse them. And in the other direction, you can import data into a database via CSV. Both of these things would not be possible if the reading and writing CSV files could only happen at the edge of the pipeline. So with that, back to Ismail for some patterns of how do you actually implement these kinds of composable I/O connectors.
Okay. Not the this thing. Thank you. Okay, so the first, before we talk about these patterns, we are going to talk about general principles we have in Beam. These are like things that we don't sacrifice when we discuss how we design our APIs. First one is correctness is really important. We always want to be consistent at the highest level that the connectors support. We try to never mask errors. We always send this out so people discover that something happened and something failed. Of course, we care about APIs. We want to have the most declarative possible APIs. We try to prefer native data types for the APIs. Not sometimes not possible, but most of the time. And in general, recently we have started to create transforms that are modular and composable. This is a new transform called read-all that is starting to become a pattern in the project. If you care about this, sorry.
No, you can go.
Okay, so you want to take more in detail, you can take this principle in those two links. And more critical is this, some surprises some people who come to Beam is that we don't like knobs in Beam in general, but in iOS in particular. I mean, synthesizers are nice, but this can be complex, and when you have to deal with so many options and parameters in production, well, this is not so easy. But more than because it's a pain of maintenance, it's also because it reflects a deeper problem that is a pain of, scalability in the long term. Some of these knobs in connectors assume things, and these assumptions don't translate easily between different systems. That is what Beam tries to do. And if you want to think about the pain, if you know Hadoop or Spark, I'm talking about this Spark dot something runtime variables that made you cry sometimes, or Hadoop. So we try to avoid all of this. So first we're going to look at patterns to read the data. First let's talk about the typical read in Beam. As we said before, we used to have a source API like Spark and Flink does. But in the end, if you look deep into the problem, what all of these systems do is just do a pardo to split the things that we are going to read, and then we do a read on any one of those. And of course, the way you split changes depending on the system. If it's files, well, you read ranges of bytes. If it's the Cassandra table, where you look at the partition ranges and you scan the partition range when you read. So this is the typical read. But when you compose things in these frameworks, in particular when you compose pardos or maps, there is a common optimization technique that is called fusion. And the idea of this is that in order to execute faster, we try to unify the two chain functions so we don't have to materialize the output of those. And it's good for performance, but sometimes has issues, in particular in two cases. If this data that is coming out from A is a really, really big amount of data, let's say like a huge flat map, well, we will probably be wasting some workers that won't be able to process all this data because they're waiting. And the other case, if B is really heavy, I mean, let's say for example that A is just the name of the image and B is a really complex image that we are going to process. Well, again, we are losing parallelism because we are not we are only doing this in one worker. So. To solve this first common issue, what we have is the concept of reshuffle. Reshuffle is a transforming beam that what it does is just to reshuffle the jobs, the task in the system. And for the case we discussed, if we had a really big amount of output in the first transform, we can put a reshuffle in the middle, and this forces us to read in parallel the splits that we have. Or we, if we had the second case, well, we can put it in the output, so we redistribute the execution into the different workers. Another thing that we have is, and this is similar to the slide that we presented before, when you are reading, if you think about a composable approach to read from Kafka, what you are doing is you are waiting for new results to come, and from a partition or from a topic, and you produce output. But if you think about the terms of Pardue or maps, you cannot produce infinite output for a given input, so this is a limitation we have. And it's the same with if you are doing this for files. If you are reading for files, well, probably you can read the whole file, but you cannot parallelize further this processing of the file if you are using one of the current transforms. And if you cannot subdivide this, you cannot benefit of ideas of BIM like liquid sharding, that is this idea of optimizing the execution of the distribution when there are delays or stragglers in the system. So a Pardue today, what it does is simply takes an input and it produces an output, but it cannot be infinite, the output that it produces, but also it cannot be parallelized further, so what means that it cannot be subdivided. To solve this, BIM introduced a new API that is called splittable Dufon, and the idea is that we introduce the concept of restrictions as part of processing, and for each element we are going to have an associated restriction which describes what part of the work we are doing, with the idea of subdividing this. Let's say that this can be, for example, for the case of a file, we can have the offsets of where that, and if you think about it, if we have a big chunk of offset, we can subdivide this in the middle. The idea is to have something that we can subdivide. For the case of big table, of course, you can have a range of keys, or for the case of Kafka, we have also the offsets. Seeing this graphically, we have this red box that is the element, and we have the restriction that we can supersplit. And we can split as we want, and we can execute it in parallel if we want or not, but well, ideally in parallel. What's interesting is also that these restrictions can be subsplitted, and if you think about it, we can have an infinite, if we have an infinite boundary, well, we can keep subsplitting, and with this we cover also the continuous case of Kafka. So we have also patterns to write to write data. And here we have two issues. One issue is that if you do per element processing, sometimes the operations can be inefficient, so we introduce batching. And also, well, how do we deal with failures in writes? So, but first let's talk about how BIM processes data, because this is a little bit particular. BIM creates like logical groups that are called bundles, and we execute these bundles. But these bundles are created by the runner. These are not manually controlled by the user, and they are not deterministic, and they can be really tiny or they can be really big. Why this? Because for a case where we care about low latency, like streaming, well, having smaller elements makes sense. For a case where we don't care about that, maybe we can have bigger bundles. So when we write with bundles, What we do is just normally we have a function with a life cycle when we set up a connection, and then we do all these kind of RPC calls, like, I don't know, to a database, for example, and when we tear down, we disconnect. But of course, if you have work in this space, you know that this doesn't scale because you will be opening a lot of more operations that you would like. So you can batch this, and BIM has a life cycle for bundles. So we have what we do in this case, we prepare a batch of data, and when we process the data, we can add more data to the batch, and at some point flush this batch and execute really the write into the RPC system. Finally, well, in finished bundle, we flush the elements that have not still been sent to the system. So this is another pattern. Okay, so now we go with retries and errors. So Beam retries every bundle that it has. This is a task of each runner. For example, Dataflow retries four times in for batch processing and multiple times for streaming. But to be able to do these retries, we ideally need that the operations we are doing should be idempotent. The good news is that most databases can do some kind of idempotent operation. For example, some of the mutations in HBase are idempotent, for example, put. But for some other system, we don't have that luxury. So we have to find workarounds. This is another pattern, the kind of workarounds we have for that. And in the case of JDBC, for example, what we can do is generate unique IDs and do this kind sort of absurd update into the database. That way we can replay the writes. For the case of files, what we do is just write temporal files and do an atomic rename when we are done. But as I said before, the bundles can be non-deterministic sometimes. And if we have, for example, an input that comes with a random ID, we will have undeterminism. And even if we have an idempotent operation in the write side, we won't have a consistent replay in case of error. So to solve this, we also can do a reshuffle. This is the return of reshuffle. And the idea is that this reshuffle forces a materialization of the input. So this way we won't have a different input when we execute the retry. There is some contention in the Beam community about reshuffle in the sense that this behavior of materializing in the same way is not part of the specification. So there is a new idea that is called a new annotation that is requires a stable input. The idea is that the do events that are marked with these annotations will guarantee this. Because so far this depends on the execution system, so this is not ideal. We should be consistent with all the systems. Finally, other pattern that we found is that even in the presence of errors, sometimes it's convenient to manually retry, and this happened, for example, this was detected with writing to a Solar database that started to complain with 429 error HTTP, that is too many writes. And because it couldn't handle the load, so what we do is to do retries at the narrowest scope, and we use an exponential backoff to do these retries. So this is a little bit how it looks in the code. So just basically we sleep, we wait a bit, and we retry. We sleep a little bit more, and we retry. Finally, the last pattern that I'm going to talk about is this dead letter queue, when we have good results and bad results, and this permanent errors that bad records we send them to a different output, and good records to a good one. So now Eugene is going to continue with the next patterns.
All right, I'm going to talk some more about patterns that are common in IOS.write data. One of the most important ones, one that's I think newly introduced in Beam to some extent, is something called dynamic destinations. So suppose that you want to write different events to different tables. You could express that by saying that different events go to different destinations, and to specify what goes where, you would need to specify some kind of destination key. So you as a user would need to say how to extract what destination it should go to, and you would need to specify for a given destination how you should write to that destination. For example, what is the table name and what is the table schema. In Beam, this approach is implemented into IOS. On the surface, you could ask, why not just do this with a group by key? So why not just take the data and group it by destination and apply like some kind of write transform within each group? I wish that was possible, but to the best of my knowledge, you cannot express this in the Beam model, meaning that you cannot express applying to a transform to every group within the result of a group by key. the result of a group by key is basically a key and a list of values. It's not a key and a parallel data set of values. So instead, this has to be done in a kind of ad hoc way in different IOs. However, it at least can be done using a similar API. And currently, two IOs provide that, one that writes to files and one that writes to BigQueries. And they both do it in the way that I described, where the user has to supply a destination key type. For example, if you're writing different customers to different tables, it can be a customer ID, a destination function that takes an event and extracts which destination it goes to, and one or more functions that, for a given destination, tell you how to configure the write to there. For example, give you a table name or a table schema or maybe a base directory or like a configuration for a file format writer and so on. So that's the API. I'm going to look at this in more detail later because I will consider file IO in particular. But for now, let's consider another pattern. Another pattern that's also specific to Beam is sequenceable writes. One of the common cases, one of the common requirements people have is to write data and then do something. For example, write data to a database, then send a Kafka message, or write a parent table and then write a child table that references it, or write files to somewhere and then ask a database to import them, and so on. You can express this. So in order to express this, you need your write operation to return some kind of results that you can sequence against. So that would be some kind of completed write results. Maybe if you're writing files, it could be file names you've written. If you're writing tables, it could be names of the tables you've written and maybe import statistics. If there is nothing of substance you can return, you can just return a signal, like a pick collection of dummy elements that signal that the write has been done. So really, there should be one write result per whatever method of writing you're actually using. So if you're doing one RPC per element, it's going to be results of the RPCs. Sure, there's going to be a lot of them. We'll deal with that soon. Maybe one per batch if you're doing batch RPCs, one file name per file you've written, and so on. However, if you're also using dynamic destinations, then of course you should also, the results should contain a destination key so that you can know which of the destinations has completed writing. There is two patterns that I'm aware of when it comes to this kind of sequencing. One is when you write data and then when it's done writing, you simply want to do something with the write results. The other pattern is when you have like some processing and you want to block part of that processing on the completion of a write. They sound kind of similar, but they're not identical. The thing about both of them is that you want, so if you return write results immediately as some of the data gets written, that's often not very useful. Really what you want to wait for is that all of the data gets written. In the next slide, I'm going to discuss how we can do that. The problem with blocking on all data being written is that it's hard to define what is all data, especially if your data is unbounded. There is no such thing as all data. Beam already controls aggregation scopes for unbounded data and for bounded data by windows. So really what you want to do is block some processing until this particular window of data is written. And we can use Beam standard aggregation operations to convert arbitrary and write results to getting one result per window. So for example, if you write some data and get some write results, maybe one per RPC or something, you can apply a combine transform that will combine all of them within a window, and then you will get one result when the whole window has finished writing. More precisely, it's going to be one per firing of a trigger within the window, but if you like, you can make it actually be one per window. And then you can do something with these write results, like maybe send a message somewhere every time a result comes in. The other pattern is that it's not that you want to do something every time a result comes in. It's that you want to unblock some processing when the respective write result is ready. In this case, Beam contains a transform called the wait transform. And you can use it to do exactly that. So if you say wait on this transform, this gives you a transform that blocks its that makes its input unavailable until the respective window of the wait input is ready. So that solves pretty much most of the cases known to me of blocking something and something else. And With that, let's consider in detail the implementation of one IO connector in Beam that demonstrates a lot of the ideas that we've considered. It's going to be writing files. In Beam, it's called file.io.write. And on the surface, writing files seems like an easy thing. Like, you know, you just stream data into the files. What can be so hard about that? Turns out there's a lot of things you need to configure and a lot of things you need to be aware of. First, the things that you need to configure. You need to configure what is the format of the individual file, so what's the layout of data in the file. That's called async. Second, you cannot write all the data to a single file, especially if the data is continuously streaming. So you need to write so-called shards, where a shard is a file that contains some of the data, but not all of it. And you can say that you want a fixed number of shards, or maybe you actually want to write all of it to one shard, or maybe you don't care how many there are as long as they add up to the data. You need to say where to place the files. You need to say when to generate the files. So realistically, that's probably going to be one set of shards written every time a window of data closes. You need to do these things in different ways for different destinations. So maybe like you want to write different files to different directories, or maybe you want to write CSV files with different headers for different customers. And finally, you want to be able to sequence this against other processing, so you need to return a collection of file names. This is roughly how it looks like. The file format interface is encapsulated by something called async, which is really simple. Like, it takes an open file channel, and you can write an element into it, and you can close it. And here is an example of writing bank transactions of different type to different directories. So you specify the destination function, and you say that the destination key is the name of the transaction type. You say what is the file format for every destination, and you say that the file format for a particular transaction type is CSV with the headers appropriate for that type of transaction. And you say how to convert every record into something that this file format can accept. You say how many shards you want per window, you say where to write it, and you say how to name the files. So you give a naming strategy, like how to assemble a file name from the directory, which shard it is, which window it is. So simple enough and pretty powerful. Now, as for the things that you need to be aware of, but the user doesn't need to be aware of. So when you're implementing writing to files, there is a lot of caveats. First, you need your final files to kind of be a consistent snapshot of the data, even if there are failures or retries or zombie workers that keep writing the files after you think they're not. So you need to write data to temp files first and then atomically rename them to final files. And you need to, of course, rename only the ones that wrote successfully and clean up those that didn't. Now, if you're writing to many destinations at the same time, you need to limit how many files you write at the same time from one worker, or you're going to run out of memory for write buffers. If the user has requested 10 shards and you had like only 3 records, you still need to create 10 shards, 7 of them empty or more. And there are some performance optimizations you may want to perform. I'll talk about them later. So at a high level, this transform is composed of 2 subtransforms, one that takes elements and writes them to temp files and returns information about the temp files that were written, which is the destination key to which this temp file relates, the shard, and the name of the file. And the second transform takes these temp files and finalizes them, meaning that for each destination, it renames the set of temp files generated for that window for that destinations to their final locations, and it cleans up the needed temp files. So at a high level, it's these 2 transforms, but both of them are pretty complex. The one that writes temp files, you take the elements, you group them by key and generate a shard number, and then you take each group and write it, like open a new temp file for that group and write to it. And you need to be aware of writing too many files at the same time. Then the destination key can be pretty heavyweight, so you really don't necessarily want to ask Beam to group by destination key. So instead, we group by a hash of the destination key, which can be much more lightweight and do some more grouping in memory in that writing thing. So the reason I'm going into this in so much detail is really to show you that there is a lot going on, but Beam allows you to do all of it, and it's So Beam does not get in the way of you doing arbitrarily complex stuff when developing an I/O connector, because you can decompose things and use the Beam programming model to just parallelize whatever you're doing. So in case the number of shards is variable and not fixed, then it gets quite a bit more complex. So you take elements and you just stream them into temp files right away. And if you run the danger of writing too many temp files at the same time, then you cannot write them right now. So instead, you have to spill them into a separate p-collection. And you apply the method of writing to a fixed number of shards to that collection. So you get some temp files that were written immediately and some temp files that were too much for the worker, and you write them separately. So here again, you can see how Beam allows you to just decouple the different stages of the quite complex code for writing files, and Beam orchestrates them for you, retries them individually for you, parallelizes them for you. This would not be conceivable with a rigid API that just like expresses a sync at the edge of the pipeline. And now the second transform that finalizes temp files. So you get a data set of information about the temp files. You want to gather them together so that you know what are all the temp files, so you group them onto a single fake key. You stabilize that so that you don't get results about temp files that are are not final and did not succeed writing. And then you generate the final file names for every group of temp files, rename them, and clean up. So overall, it's a pretty complex transform. Like, not horribly complex, but gets the job done. Okay. So a bit about future work. The future work as I is pretty much about taking these ideas further. Some of these ideas were developed fairly recently, and not all I/O connectors support them yet. For connectors that write data, we want more of them to support dynamic destination style of writing. And actually, the API for writing files is much better than the API for writing to BigQuery, so we would like BigQuery to adopt a similar style of API as well. We want more IOs to support sequencing. For example, people have been asking, I think, for years to be able to do something after you write to BigQuery, but the BigQuery connector does not support that yet. Currently, only the file connector and spanner support that. When it comes to reading data in a composable way, first, a bunch more work needs to happen regarding support of splittable defuns and runners. Quite a lot of it is supported. For example, all runners support splittable defuns that emit a bounded amount of data per input, but not all yet support unbounded data per input. There needs to be some support for it in the portability framework and so on. So it's actually a fundamentally new programming primitive, like map and group by key are programming primitives. Splittable map is a third one. It's like on that scale of complexity. So it needs a lot of support. After that support happens, or in some cases that can be done earlier, we need IO connectors that read data to support reading collections of read configurations. For example, when you read files in Beam, you can give it a collection of file names, and it will read each of them, and the collection can be computed dynamically. But not all IO connectors support that style of reading yet. And finally, once we convert all the IO connectors to this composable way of doing things, Beam's legacy APIs for reading data. Beam used to have an API for reading data that's much like the Hadoop and Spark and Flink APIs called the source API. That API still exists. So once all of the work above happens, that API can be put to rest finally once and for all. That's pretty much it. We're happy to take questions.